Accession number 30021.
Sam King, Real One. If we could start with when and where you were born, please.
My name is Samuel King. I was born at Priestman's River, Portland, Jamaica, the 20th of February 1926, into a Christian family with a farming background. I went to Fair Prospect School until I was 15. My father was ill, and I had to take over the farm, and by the time I was 16, I was hiring and firing. Being the eldest son, my father, like his father, was so sure that I was going to be a farmer, a peasant farmer. The bloody Germans tried to take over the world, and the British asked for God's sake, send us more men and planes. I volunteered. Now, in the colonies, when you volunteer, you have to pass the academic and medical tests. I took the test, and it surprised me. Out of about 200, I was high up. And they called my name, and I didn't answer. And somebody said, "Something's your name." Right, joined the Royal Air Force, went to RAF Mona, square bashing for about a month.
What did that involve?
That in my drilling, and when you're a civilian, they turn you around and they tell you to go, and subconsciously you should go, and they should tell you to stop you from that. So it's drilling, rifle, and general discipline. Then in October, we went on the SS Cuba, a troop ship. It's one of the worst ships I've ever been on. And in those days, for every three ships that attempt to cross the Atlantic, one is killed at the bottom. Those bloody Germans have Wolfpack submarines string out along the road. So we went to New York, picked up a convoy, went all ice and running about, and arrived at Greenock on the 9th of November, 1944. I was glad to be in dry land. And when I came to England or Britain, I was shocked. Glasgow was bombed, and the condition, I was from a poor background, but there's certain stability. But I know about war, but when you actually see it, it's frightening. We took a troop train from the Clyde down to Filey near Scarborough. We square bashing there until January. Those bloody Germans at the Battle of the Bulge. It's an unpleasant. Tanks running all over Europe again and all that. And the Air Force, we had to work very hard and get the Air Force going and caught the German panzers out in the open and shot them up like rabbits. And gradually, as you know, D-Day carried on. And once we got into Europe, the Americans, to me, have their Spitfires, and like the American cowboys, they just put petrol in, go up, and you have a line, just for argument's sake, you have a line along the Elbe, and you shouldn't cross it. Anything over that, if it's cow, man, they shoot it up. Unfortunately, sometimes somehow men get there too far. As a matter of fact, the last Jamaican to be killed, Spitfire pilot, was shot down by an American. And they're still doing it today, which is sad. If I did aircraft recognition, 2 days, they train you to spot aircraft coming at you, measurement, mosquitoes, and whatever it is. And I was hoping to get about 80 percentage. I only got 70. And I was worried. And the sergeant said, "Don't worry, my boy. When a measurement shoot at you, it will get into your brain. You will remember." And he was right.
Could you talk a bit more about the pilot training?
No, I was not trained as a pilot. I was trained as an engineer. And I've been to 16 different stations. The trouble is, when you are an engineer on maintenance, you repair part of a squadron, they move, you have to move. I remember Arnhem, they had the gliders were at RAF Rivenal. We went to work on the gliders for the paratroopers. Of course, they don't tell you what it's about, but normally we don't work on gliders. and we should wait for the gliders to come back. You know what happened, sir? The gliders then didn't come back. So a couple of days after, I was posted to RAF Desborough, which I think it was Dakotas. So you've been around, and you do what you're told, but they don't tell you what they're doing. For example, later on, I was at RAF District, near Ripon, working on York Transport Plane. And it was cold. And I sent some men out, and I think they said I was in charge, and I told them to get that the ice and sort out, you know, take it out, because they don't need it anymore. Of course, they don't told us that the plane need to go to the Far East to beat those bad Japanese, and it must turn around within a week. Anyway, he said he could not repair the plane because it's too cold. I went, and when I touched the metal, sir, my hand burned like fire. So we could not repair the plane. So we run up and down and you do things, but they don't give you all of it. I was at RAF Cranfield. Normally I'm not radar and all that, but I went there because they want a man, and I was in a van that goes around mosquitoes coming back from bombing. And to land, try and remember, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock, and they have circuits, and whatever it is, I have to go around with them. And it was very hard. And after about a month, they said, you are out. And I went to RAF Locking near Western Supermere. You name it, I've been there. So from RAF Orkinch near Folkestone to RAF Kenrath in Elgin, Scotland, and nearly as wide I've been. I know the bus routes of Manchester and Nottingham better than London.
Did you have any difficulty?
The docks, to get people to work at the docks and work on the gas works. Anyway. Housing was short, schooling and all that, and they blame everything on the immigrants. The politicians make that, it's like now. The politicians said it's the immigrants and all that. True, the immigrants create problems, but those problems were there. So gradually, as more of us start coming, it becomes more difficult. And the neo-fascists, we fought the Germans and the other things, and we survived. Then we come National Front in 1950 in our backyard at home. Say Campbell Pickett. That was bad. And some of them says the German system was better.
If we go back a bit to before 1944, how much of the war were you aware while you were in Jamaica still?
When I was at school, every morning, if the news was good, the headmaster was British. I don't get wrong, he's a Jamaican. But if the news was good, he'd read it to the old school. So I was aware about the war. Also, I had the privilege, my father went to America as a young man, and he brought back a book, The Nations at War, about the First World War. And I read it from cover to cover. Secondly, I was 15 miles from Motown, and I don't know if you're aware of it, so the Maroons in Jamaica fought your people for 200 years. And you did not completely capture them. So I grew in an environment where youngsters, and I'm from a Ashanti background, and where the young men had some training. So I had a bit about the war. So, yes, I learned about the war. And I was well aware of Germans sinking ships. I'll give you an example. We live about half a mile from the shore. And sometimes when you go down there, you see woods, timber from Canada, oil drums and all that, and people take them until the police says, no, you don't have anything to do with the oil drums. We're not against you taking away the timber and all that. So, yes. And in the West Indies, we're rushing. We used to get rice cheaper from China. There was hardly any rice. Those bloody Germans keep sinking the food ship even down there.
To what extent did people in Jamaica and the West Indies as a whole feel that they were involved in the war?
Sir Stafford Scripps said, for God's sake, send us more plane and men. Most schools, the children save pennies, sir, to buy a squadron of Spitfire. And it is recorded that Jamaica was one of the first countries outside of Britain to buy a squadron of Spitfire. And we gave pennies. We didn't have much money, gave pennies.
Was there a strong feeling of loyalty then towards
Spitfire? Oh, yes, the mother country. In my case, when I was 18, I passed to go to America to work at the farms or factory. And when you work in America farms, the men who came back with some money. They do that in the summer, spring, and they come back for the winter and all that. and about a week after I passed to come into the Royal Air Force, my mother looked me in my face and says, "My son, the mother country is at war. Go, and if you live, it will be a good thing." And most people were like that. We are aware that we were a colony, but Britain was better than Germany. I mean, you don't have to be bright to realise that. At least the British play cricket and they'll let you back. But the Germans don't let you back.
Your parents approved of your joining the RAF then?
My mother said, "Yes, my son, go. And if you live, it will be a good thing." She was right. She could see ahead of me.
What was it that made you choose the RAF? Was there any question of joining the Air Force or the Navy or the Army?
I would like, at one stage, I would like the Navy, not the, the Navy, not the Army. I'm aware that Army marchmen down and sleep in water and shoot and run. But when you're in a ship and with big guns and all that, boom, 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 that's nice. And I am aware that with Air Force, you have more. But there's another side. They asked for men for the Royal Air Force. I did have a West Indian regiment during the First World War and the Second World War. But I don't know. I wasn't interested in the Army at that stage. It's when they asked for men for the Royal Air Force. And I think the background to it, the fact that we had to take a test, it makes it a little bit, I will go, man. And the test was academic, but not so much. I remember if A was B or whatever it is, I could make decisions. Because when I was 16, I was hiring and firing. So making decision wasn't too bad. And my score wasn't bad. And, sir, a week after arriving in England, I went to night school during the war. You know why? I realized that science and things like that, I didn't have enough. And I benefited from it. And my brothers and sisters who joined me after the war, if they arrive on a Monday, they have their documentation on a Tuesday, they start working on a Wednesday, roughly. A week, a fortnight after, they should start going to night school. In the end, most of them became academically and more materially better than I am. One of my sisters became the matron of St. Giles Hospital, Camberwell Green, a King's College group. Another sister, she was trained at East London. She is now the Director of Social Services in Etobicoke, Toronto. So the girls had an easier time because once you are intelligent enough to be a nurse, and in those days they need midwives, I think they still need midwives today. And if you could pass the exam, you go on. But the boys had a little harder time. I know cases where people are engineers, and when they turn up at the factory, nothing, I mean, it's in my book. The union says you didn't do your apprenticeship. So the manager said yes, but the Mac, they said no, you didn't do the apprenticeship yet. Well, his girlfriend mother, that's Nottingham, was sick, and when said the girlfriend said, "I'm moving," she said, "No, my mother is sick. As the only house we have, you have to stick it out." After about 6 months, the foreman went ill, the machine broke down, and who could set the micrometer and all that? Him. So they call him the sweeper. And after that, he became an engineer. But the unions were not very helpful in many cases. If you were from the colonies, in theory, you didn't do 5 years apprentice. Fair enough, but you've got a bit of paper. I work an aircraft from Lysanders or Hansen to Lancasters. Most of them at, say, British Airways, or whatever, they work on 1 year aircraft. But that's not it. They did their apprenticeship and that, and they're sticking to it. Rubbish.
Did you go to night school then with a particular ambition in mind for after the war?
I went to night school knowing that I have to, especially in England, be a bit more academic, especially in science, than I was in the colonies. I could read and write, but I remember getting an exam paper in the RAF. Why do they put salt on the road? Well, of course, they put salt on the road to melt it. But that's not the answer. There is a scientific reason. And things like that. And by going to night school, I could able to improve a little bit better.
Was that for a particular career that you had in mind, though?
No. When I was in the Air Force, I was doing civil engineering at night school. Sorry, not night school. Through the post office, plumbing and all that and all that. So I intend to work in the building trade when I finish, but I still know that you need some more. I'll give an example. When I was at the RAF, I forgot which one, there was a call for resettlement and people who wants to go on a refresher course for plumbing at a place in Oxfordshire, near Whitney, where the blanket place is. And I applied. The gentleman said, I'm from the colonies. What do you know about plumbing? I said, well, I took my papers that I have every week and said, I do sanitary engineering, and now that. He said, all right, well, you have been doing that, so go. Anyway, there were 18 people in the class. One fellow was from Derby. His father owned a plumbing business. He was cock of the hoop, and oh, yes, we can employ a few of you if you finish. I think it was a month's course or 3 weeks. It was a kind of a resettlement. It was a Saturday morning. The officer dishing out the awards. I was sweeping up the thing, typical currents, they give you that. It doesn't really matter. And it said, well, the awards are there. Sam King, you wouldn't believe it, he came top. And this fellow, he was very so angry. He came about fifth. No, he had done plumbing all his life. But he has only done plumbing in practice. The theory, I don't think he worried about that because he has a job when he go. But in my case, I had to go and look for a job. So, yes, I was geared for the building industry. And when I came out, I worked during my leave. You have about 2 months leave after the war, and I work at a different site. But again, like the aircraft, when you touch pipes in -2, it's a bit unpleasant. So I took the test for the post office and I passed, and I spent 34 years there. It was a good thing. And when, from the post office, by the way, I was at the Southwest District Office, and I used to go at the back of the palace to the mouses of the horse to collect the mail, certain one of the duties. Right, we were at Aldgate, Old Street Post Office, and I got there this Monday morning to train as a sorter. And there were about 15 of us. And two of them came, some were very sorry, but I don't think you could pass the test, I know you've been a postman, but in England. I said, I'll try. I think it's a 3 weeks or a month, no, 3 weeks course. After about 2.5 weeks, a fellow that used to work at Harrods, he asked for a test. He took the test 2 days early, he passed. Of course, he used to do all the dispatches all over Britain. Next day, I asked for a test. The man said, oh, can you ask for a test? I did East Anglia as my main one. Now, in East Anglia, you have 12 markets, and people get them mixed up. Anyway, he said, all right, yes, you can have the test. I have the test. It's 500 cards for 60 minutes. If you get less than 5 right, wrong, you pass. I got 2 wrong. So I passed. The man said, oh, can you pass that? He said, I marked the cards. I said, well, give me another good one. He got the governor, the big boss from upstairs, and stood behind me, and they gave me a new one. Funny enough, I got 2 wrong again, but not the same 2. And the governor said, how do you pass the test, especially East Anglia, and that? I said, I don't study them. I just make up in a sound. Which that's what I did. Back to my other friends. 2 of them failed. And they had to go back as postmen. They couldn't be sorted. But the fact that I came from the colonies, I couldn't be a sorter in England. And geography was not bad for me. I look at the place and I see where it is, and it's there. And again, the 12 markets in East Anglia, people keep mixing them. Reader Market, Butter Market. New Market, put New Market in and all that. And things to make it confusing. But by the grace of God, I survived.
If we go back a bit again, when you first During your basic training, how did you find adjusting to military life?
Hard. I remember when we were at Mona, St. Andrew, Jamaica, after about a week training, we went in a run from Mona to Papine. I think it was 5 miles in the morning. It was only 6 o'clock in the morning, 6:30. And when we came back, we complained to the officer about that. We had to run 5 miles. And anyway, next day, the sergeant said, right, full pack. We ran 5 miles empty. Now we're going to do that with the pack. I think it was about 45 pounds, slightly unpleasant. So I find it hard. But if you had to do it, you don't get failure during the war. And they somehow push you off the path. If you can't, if some people are not medically fit, fair enough, but you had a path and they'll give you a job somewhere down the line. Of course, when you came to England, or when we came to England, we had to have another test, the same test. But I don't know why. It's typical if you come from the colonies, they might think you're not right. In my case, I passed again. But surprisingly, there were 15 of us in the village at Filey. Two fellows did not pass. No, there's a reason for that. Typical Jamaica, this fellow was something like 17. He didn't take the test. His brother, who was 19, took the test for him. So the names were roughly the same and everything. And medical was much different, but when he took it again, he didn't take it in the first place, he failed. Of course, they didn't send him back, and they gave him a general duty sweep, not all the way it is. But he genuinely wanted to come to war, but according to them, you have to pass a test to come to war.
And how did you find adjusting to life in Britain?
Very hard. I remember the first time I came to England during the war, I landed at Greenock into 3 inches of snow. And I was looking at it, and the sergeant said, move! You're not dead! He stayed on the ground for a month. Slightly different from 85 degrees most days. And I find it very hard. But anyway, after about 3 weeks, we complained how cold we are. There was no heating in the billet because training billet. And again, the sergeant made a work out and said, right, strip! We're going to play football. And we play football on a pitch, but as it worked out, they said you have to pile up because there were anti-tank mines there. So we were running an anti-tank mine. And we start sweating. And then I realized I can live here. I find it difficult, but yes, it's a mental approach. And back to the Seagraves, people were very British. We are pulled together. We had to pull together. If one woman had no sugar or sugar rations, she might ask the other name for 2 spoons of sugar. You know, things like that. And we became a part of it.
Could you talk a bit more about what the specific training for the engineering and mechanics of the aircraft involved?
Right. An aircraft, when it leaves the factory, it's ready, but not ready for the RA. You have to put on your markings, you have to put on maybe the higher de-icing or move the radar things, and the propeller is normally set, but if you're going somewhere, they're set. So it's a general one, and it's an all-round, training. And I'm proud to say that today, if you have a Lancaster or a Hanson, or preferably Dakotas, that's the American twin engine, and it's top, you just ring me, whether it's body or engine, no problem. Not jets. I didn't go on a jet course. I know nothing about jets. And I felt good to be a part of Britain doing my little bit. And I'll give you an example. My father wrote me, and afterwards he told me. In my book, it says that my family's farm is border onto Errol Flynn. And Errol Flynn's father and my father were friends. Errol Flynn's father was a deacon at St. Mark's Church, Boston. My father was a deacon. Anyway, Errol Flynn's father, you're telling Errol is in the film, you know, and you've got Burma and all that. And my father looked at his face, my son is over there. I don't know if you know, Errol Flynn didn't work in forces, you know. Did you know that? He failed the test. Say, Sam King tell you that Errol Flynn was not in the forces, although he conquered Burma, because he failed the test. And my father was privileged enough to look his father in the face and said, my son is over there.
If an aircraft came back from a sortie badly damaged, was there a limit to how much you could repair before it had to be?
Yes, the difference in mosquitoes, a lot of people don't realise that mosquitoes would make of plywood covered by fabric. The chief engineer would assess the damage. If it's just the wing and all that, you're going to cut out that bit, put a new bit in, cut the fabric, you're going to do it right, and put the dope on and all that. And in theory, when you finish the aircraft, if the average speed was, say, 500 miles, it shouldn't be less. It should be more. So, yes, you, the small man down there, didn't make the decision. It's the chief engineer assess. And sometimes you have to cannibalize it, take bits off work and then put on the other one. A standard joke for we, the older ones, you tell the boys then that when it was so bad during the war, you take your handkerchief to repair a mosquito. It was that bad as that one. Because it's fabric covered, you lay down a bit. If it wasn't true, we always have material.
Yeah. And what about the planes that were metal bodies?
Like Dakotas. I mean, Dakota Spitfire is nice, but I like Dakotas simply. It's like a Ford engine, like a Ford car. It was easier to work and everything. Of course, it's American. But my own love from aircraft is Dakota to work on. I don't like Lancasters. You have big ladders and, oh God, chops away, chops nearly as heavy as half of your weight. It had to be done.
How was the relationship between the air crew and the ground crew?
Very good. You depend on your ground crew for your aircraft. Most of the men took the aircraft as theirs, which is right. And it is, Fred, you know, there is a bullet hole and whatever it is, and I want it back tomorrow. They're very good. And you respect the ground crew as much as the air crew. Not for the air crew, real cream boy and all that, all the girls. But you, the engineer, if you don't do it right, even today, if the aircraft is right, it's only 200 people going to die. I don't know if you're aware of it. When you work on an aircraft in the forces, you say change the de-icing. You sign for it. The inspecting engineer should sign to say he's checked it. I think there was a case in the Atlantic where some door flew off. The man was new, repaired the door, and the inspector didn't check it. Very serious. Let's do two signatures.
You had a set list of procedures to go through.
Oh, yes.
Could you, what did that involve?
No, I couldn't tell you one here because each one is different. But one, you have to check what is wrong. No, sorry. You didn't get the procedure. You're normally given the sheet by the chief engineer what needs doing. And then you work through that. No, I, the normal airman, didn't have to make that decision. The big boss make it. And you have to work to, say, in a week's time to turn around 4 aircraft, whatever it is, just too bad. If you only sleep 8 hours or whatever it is. And you gladly do it. And I remember I was at the RAF Rivenor near Witham, I think it was Arnhem. When you see aircraft and gliders almost black out the sky, when you have 2,000 raids carrying gliders, it's a good sight. But those bloody Germans didn't let the gliders come back. But we were waiting for the gliders. Let them again let it